Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem Theaterpodcast für den Herrn, der Kalorienzählen für höchst unpatriotisch hält. Bin ja irgendwie immer noch in New York, schaue mich weiter hier auf verschiedenen Bühnen um. Was mir ganz stark in Erinnerung geblieben ist von den Sachen, die ich jetzt so gesehen habe hier in New York, ist so eine ganz starke Konzentration auf das Persönliche. Viel mehr als in Deutschland, ehrlich gesagt. Arbeiten, die behaupten und das auch sehr erfolgreich behaupten, dass dieses Persönliche irgendwie universal ist. Ich glaube, da gibt es auch in Deutschland so einen Widerwillen, das so anzunehmen. Das liegt auch an diesen Kulturförderungsanträgen, die man dort ja stellen muss in Deutschland. Also, dass man immer sehr deutlich erklären muss, worauf will ich hinaus, was möchte ich genau erzählen. Und hier habe ich den Eindruck, funktioniert das häufig auch umgekehrt. Zu sagen, es geht um mich, ich bin das Kunstwerk und ich stelle mich hier mit meiner Geschichte und mit einer sehr spezifischen Geschichte auf die Bühne. Und eine seltsame Art und Weise, je spezifischer diese Geschichte ist und je persönlicher und abseitiger und detaillierter, umso universeller erscheint sie mir dann auch. Also zum Beispiel Macbeth and Stride, das war ein Stück in der Brooklyn Academy of Music, ist ein ganz toller Raum, so ein bisschen runtergekommen, erinnert mich so etwas an die Sophiensäle, allerdings irgendwie in größer und dann doch Kuckkastenbühne. Dort hat Whitney White, eine Schauspielerin, Regisseurin, Stückemacherin, A Black, eine Show gemacht, basierend auf Macbeth, beziehungsweise eben ganz speziell der Figur der Lady Macbeth. Und sie setzt sich da mit ihrem Schwarzsein, mit ihrem Frausein auseinander und was das bedeutet. Und das Ganze aber in so einer Form einer Musical-Solo-Show, wobei es dann am Ende doch keine Solo-Show ist. Es tritt dann doch noch der weiße heterosexuelle Mann auf als Macbeth. Ich hätte gut ohne den leben können, weil so schreiende weiße Männer sehe ich im deutschen Theater eigentlich eh genug. Aber sie hat diese Figur dann noch eingeführt. Her Game, Her Rules. Und das Ganze funktionierte dann so wie eine Art, ja, wie so eine Art Motown-Rock-Soul-Show. Also sie war die Frontfrau und es gab noch, angelehnt an die drei Hexen bei Macbeth, so drei schwarze Background-Sängerinnen, die in so einem ganz tollen Moment am Anfang eigentlich wie so stumm mit diesen Motown-Gesten, diesen Dreier-Gesten, die man von Background-Sängerinnen vielleicht kennt, wenn die so ein bisschen choreografiert sind, die haben ja quasi fast so was Magisches, die dann sozusagen diesen ganzen Abend aus diesen stummen Pop-Background-Choreo-Bewegungen entstehen lassen. Irgendwann tritt sie dann auf und dann sind es quasi wirklich ziemlich starke Songs, zwar unterbrochen von am Ende dann auch ziemlich vielen Shakespeare-Szenen, wenn dann diese Macbeth-Figur auftritt, aber am Anfang auch ziemlich vielen theoretischen Gedanken, praktischen Gedanken zu ihrem Leben als schwarze Frau, schwarze Performerin. Was bedeutet es, wenn man Karriere machen will? Ist man abhängig von Männern? Ist man abhängig von weißen Männern? Wie verhält man sich? Das fand ich, manchen Stellen hatte das was extrem Didaktisches, aber an manchen Stellen auch wahnsinnig, wahnsinnig unterhaltend. Auch Oh Mary, davon habe ich ja letztes Mal schon gesprochen, ist in dem Sinne nicht wirklich eine Solo-Show, aber ist natürlich total auf Cole Escola als Performer zugeschnitten, der quasi seine Liebe zu alten Stars, Broadway, Kabarett-Legenden, Washed-Up-Diven auslebt in dieser Mary Todd Lincoln-Fantasie. Das Tolle an diesem Ding ist, dass er sich da halt hinstellt und am Ende dann in diese Kabarett-Nummer abdriftet, in der er irgendwie diesen ganzen Traum wahrmacht in hautengen Oberteil und so sensible Heels. Also er hat da nicht die ganz hohen Hacken an, sondern so ein bisschen so, was so die älteren Ladies anhaben, ne? So halbhoch, viertelhoch. Und diese ganze Show ist einfach total um ihn als Charakter herum gestrickt und ist ohne diese Persönlichkeit, es haben inzwischen auch schon andere hier am Broadway gespielt, aber ist ohne ihn als Macher und als diese Persönlichkeit, die er ist, eigentlich überhaupt gar nicht denkbar. Und ich habe das Gefühl, gegenüber solchen Geschichten, so ganz persönlichen Geschichten, gibt es in Deutschland immer ein ganz großes Misstrauen. Das Theater zum Beispiel bei Oh Mary, es ist in New York ja üblich, da hängen zum Teil ja in den Theatern, auch wenn es kaum riesig große Foyers oder Aufenthaltsräume gibt, aber immer ziemlich viele Fotos oder Szenenfotos, kleine Plakate von Shows, die historisch da mal gelaufen sind. Das geht dann meistens zurück bis irgendwie in die 50er. Und das ist in diesem Oh Mary Play natürlich anders. Da hängen nur Fotos von ihm. Und zwar in ganz verschiedenen Rollen, als ob er durch die ganzen Jahrzehnte immer nur er da gespielt hätte. Es hängt auch ein riesiges Ölgemälde von ihm gleich neben dem Boxoffice, da wo man die Karten kauft. Also das ganze Theater verwandelt sich quasi in einen Schrein für Cole. Eine andere Soloshow war Hold Me in the Water. Playwrights Horizons, auch eine ziemlich kleine Show, die geschrieben und performt wurde von Ryan J. Haddad, in der er eine schwule Liebesgeschichte, eigentlich eine ganz einfache Geschichte, erzählt, aber er ist ein Autor und Schauspieler mit einer Zerebralparese oder er lebt mit einer Behinderung und benutzt so eine Art Walker, so ein Metallgestell. Er kommt dann tatsächlich mit einem total tollen Kostüm und diesem Metallgestell am Anfang hochgefahren. Das Ganze ist dann so eine Art Mischung aus Stand-up und Theatermonolog, zwischendurch sexuell total explizit. Das ist auch so eine, eigentlich so eine ganz kleine Geschichte. Er ist natürlich auch ein toller Erzähler gewesen und das schlägt auch immer dann, auch wenn es tragisch wird, ja immer, ich spreche später auch mit Taylor Mac darüber, es zwinkert der Tragödie immer so zu und kippt dann ja immer ins Witzige. So auch hier. Da fand ich, gab es einen total schönen Moment, wenn er am Anfang aus dieser Versenkung hochgefahren wird. Das gibt ihm natürlich erstmal so einen ganz tollen, eleganten Auftritt und einen effektvollen Auftritt und auch eine andere Art von Auftritt, als er das wahrscheinlich mit seinem Walker hätte machen können, wenn er jetzt, weiß ich nicht, von der Seite hereingekommen wäre. Und dann spielt er, bevor das Stück tatsächlich losgeht, so eine Art von Ouvertüre, die aber auch schon so in diesem Tonfall dieser privaten Erzählung ist, in der er aber auch erzählt, wie man dieses Stück noch benutzen kann, wenn man zum Beispiel eine Person ist, die nicht besonders gut sieht. Also er beschreibt sein Outfit, wie er aussieht, wie die Bühne aussieht, beschreibt er. Er beschreibt auch, dass das Licht nicht komplett ausgemacht wird, sondern dass das eine Art Relaxed-Performance ist. Man soll kommen und gehen, wann man will. Und es gibt draußen einen Bereich, wo man sich auch mal kurz zurückziehen kann, wenn man Ruhe braucht. Das Ganze aber in so einem total witzigen, angenehmen Tonfall, wo man sich tatsächlich fragt, warum gibt's das nicht öfters? Lag natürlich auch an ihm, dass er das so wahnsinnig charmant gemacht hat. Er meinte dann noch so, und er bittet darum, wenn man pinkeln gehen will, soll man einfach pinkeln gehen. Er müsse vielleicht auch mittendrin mal pinkeln gehen. Who knows, was passiert. Er will nicht derjenige sein, der einen davon abhält, auf Toilette zu gehen. Also bitte, wenn man mittendrin raus will und dann einfach wieder rein. Ihm wäre das egal. Ganz, ganz angenehm. Dann eine Solo-Show, die gegensätzlicher nicht sein könnte, war Hugh Jackman in der Radio City Music Hall. Das ist ja ein riesiges Haus. Also ich weiß nicht, wie viel tausend Leute da reingehen. Das ist extrem beeindruckend. Ganz tolle Architektur, wenn man da drin sitzt. Ich habe richtig Gänsehaut gekriegt, weil man kennt diesen Raum natürlich. Man kennt auch diesen gerafften, glänzenden Vorhang. Hugh Jackman trat dort auf, erinnerte sich an seine Karriere, sang so Songs aus seiner Karriere. Ich fand das wirklich grauenvoll. Ich will ja hier eigentlich nicht bewerten, sondern eigentlich eher so ein bisschen beobachten. Aber da schlug wirklich für mich das Amerikanische so ins richtig Vulgäre um. Also das fand ich richtig Stadthalle Gelsenkirchen. In natürlich groß und wahnsinnig professionell, aber es klang irgendwie furchtbar scheppernd. Am Anfang legt ein Orchester los und man denkt gleich so, soll das so eine irische kleine Spelunkenband sein? Spielt es irgendwie darauf an? Ist er aus Irland? Ist das jetzt so eine Referenz auf irgendwelche Anfänge in Irland? Und ich sage, nee, der ist doch aus Australien. Also dieses riesige Orchester klingt wie eine Schratzelband. Es gibt von Hindemith doch eine fliegende Holländer-Ouvertüre, die er nachkomponiert hat, wie ein Chororchester am späten Samstagnachmittag leicht angetrunken. Also wo Hindemith die fliegende Holländer-Ouvertüre in quasi so ganz schlecht und dilettantisch nachkomponiert hat, aber total exakt. So ein bisschen so klangen diese Arrangements in der Radio City Music Hall für Hugh Jackman, dass man hörte immer so einzelne krähende Geigen. Und also es war denkwürdig. Am Anfang, wenn dieses Orchester einsetzte, dieses irische Waschbrettorchester, keine Ahnung, wie ich das nennen soll, es war ja ein Riesenorchester, es waren viele Geigen, aber es klang wie zwei. Geht dieser geraffte Vorhang hoch, das war fast der tollste Moment, wenn sich dieser Radio City Music Hall Vorhang in Bewegung setzt. Dann kommen links und rechts, gehen noch so zwei Vorhängchen auf und da kommen zwei alte Orgeln rausgefahren, die irgendwie so mechanisch sich nach vorne bewegen können, die von zwei Herren gespielt werden. Die erste halbe Stunde funktionierten die rück. Es gab eine riesige LED-Leinwand, die funktionierte irgendwie nicht. Das heißt, er kam vorher raus und kündigte an, das Ding funktioniert nicht, wir fangen jetzt aber trotzdem an. Und spekulierte so ein bisschen auf das Entgegenkommen des Publikums, das auch wahnsinnig entgegenkommend war. Das sind die Amerikaner im Theater, finde ich, eh. Also ich habe den Eindruck, selbst wenn irgendwas ganz Furchtbares vor ihnen abläuft, können die Amerikaner eine Begeisterung an den Tag legen. Das ist beeindruckend. So auch hier. Da möchte ich jetzt aber auf Taylor Mac zu sprechen kommen. Das war ein Abend, den ich gesehen habe im Pangea. Das ist eine Art Kabarett hier im East Village. Auch wiederum ein totaler Gegensatz zu dieser Radio City Music Hall Geschichte. Das Pangea ist so eine Art Kabarett Supper Club. Gibt es seit 2015 unter diesem Namen. Hieß früher The Spaghetteria 1986, 2015 dann eben Pangea. Ist eine Art Restaurant vorne und hinten geht man durch einen Vorhang und dort sind auch nochmal Tische und eine ganz, ganz kleine Bühne, wo Leute wie Penny Arcade, Joey Arias, Flotilla DeBarge, wie auch immer, so Downtown-Größen auftreten und dort vielleicht auch neue Programme ausprobieren, Sachen, die sie gerade entwickeln, zeigen. Das funktioniert dann so, dass man eine Eintrittskarte kauft, die kostet $40. Das geht an die Künstler. Und dann sitzt man noch dort und muss Drinks konsumieren oder kann sich was zu essen bestellen. Und das ist dann quasi das, was die, was diese Spielstätte, das Restaurant einnimmt. Und dort habe ich Taylor Mac gesehen, der dort Sea Shanties präsentiert hat. Er arbeitet gerade an verschiedenen Arten von Seemannsliedern, die natürlich auch so ein bisschen auf Provincetown und Fire Island und so weiter gemünzt sind. Diese ganzen Orte am Meer hier, die total queer besetzt sind oder wie so queer Sommerträume sind. Darauf aufbauend hatte er diese Idee, diese Seemannsgesänge zu komponieren. Ich glaube auch aus so ein bisschen aus so einem Impuls heraus, das sind halt Seemannsgesänge, da muss man nicht wahnsinnig viel Arbeit reinstecken, sondern ich glaube, er hatte sich so ein Limit gesetzt. Er arbeitet an jedem Song maximal 4 Stunden, um sich selber auch nicht so einen Druck zu machen. Und präsentiert diese Songs da. Er hatte so riesige Karten dabei, wo das Publikum dann auch mitsingen konnte, so handgeschrieben, dass das Publikum dann natürlich auch macht. So bekommt man eigentlich Einblick in so einen Arbeitsstand von Projekten. Ich glaube, er weiß gar nicht genau, ob das später ein Projekt wird, aber das ist was, an dem er regelmäßig arbeitet und was er quasi hier in so einem Rahmen wie dem Pangea präsentiert. Ich hatte danach Gelegenheit, mit Taylor Mac zu sprechen. Man kennt Taylor Mac ja von seinen performativen Arbeiten, 24-Hour History of American Music, ein queerer Ritt durch die amerikanische Musikgeschichte, damit war er auch im Haus der Berliner Festspiele, 24-Stunden-Stück oder auch Bark of Millions, mit dem Stück war er auch in Berlin und mit ihm habe ich gesprochen über seine Arbeiten und über seine Sicht auf amerikanisches Showbusiness.
In Germany, we have this like strict separation between like entertainment and what's called like the serious arts.
Right, and so you were wondering about what is this the hybridity of the between?
Yes, yeah. And I'm here a little bit like to talk to different people about how you guys in America deal with all this. Yeah. If it's like a, what is it called, juxtaposition? No, yeah, like if yeah. it's like a yeah. opposite ends of something. Because I have the feeling here it's everything is much more, even like the serious stuff is much more entertaining.
I think that's true. In Europe, you don't tend to wink with your serious art.
No.
And in America, the impulse from most Americans is, we're serious, but are we? Like, you know, it's hard for Americans to fully get on board with even tragedy, you know, although we have this long history of reviving tragedies over and over and over again. If you write a tragedy now, a modern tragedy, most likely they will say there's something wrong with the play. Because most playwrights don't go to Medea-level tragedy. They soften it somehow.
Yes. Do you have some kind of idea where this wink-wink situation is coming from?
It probably has to do with being a nation of immigrants and needing to have a sense of humor to get through the many barriers. And the it's not like a hunkered down ethnicity that has been here for, you know, a thousand years. It's a many, many ethnicities all having to try to figure out how to work with each other, and many ethnicities that came from other places where they were driven out. So there's more irony in America. Certainly there's more cynicism, but there's also more humor. I mean, in our mass media is so wrapped around commerce.
Yes.
and America in general is wrapped around capitalism. That is asking you to sell. So you're selling. So the wink comes from selling, you know, that the energy of the pitch.
Yeah.
And in Europe, there's, you know, I mean, at least right now, although you're all trying to model America's model, so who knows what happens, but the tradition of the culture being of the people, for the people, by the people, funded by the government, by taxes, has allowed you guys to be a little bit freer of capitalism.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's always a, like, I can give you the seriousness, but I also
I will take it back, or like it's not that serious.
Don't worry. I'm going to take care of you because I really want you to purchase the ticket
and come back.
Yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
That's interesting because both shows I saw on Broadway, Death Becomes Her, and one was Gypsy.
Right.
And both have those moments where you think like, oh, the piece is over, but then it isn't.
Right.
And then comes a little, like, it's a 5-minute scene. It's a little,
don't worry.
You know, you remember the film, maybe in the end, Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn are falling down the steps and shattering into 1,000 pieces.
Right.
They don't go there.
No. They go to the happy place.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where there's resolution for, like,
or at least they are getting old and they say, oh, let's see Les Miserables tonight.
Yeah.
And they walk
off. That is, like, super high-end musical comedy. I mean, when I say high-end, I mean millions and millions of dollar budget, you know. But yeah, I mean, Death Becomes Her. I saw it in Chicago. It's like, at the end of that musical, I was like, I never want to be gay. I never thought there was someone would kill the gay out of me, but they have just killed the gay out of me.
How did they do that?
Well, it was just, it was funny. I mean, you know, like the first act is hysterical and the stagecraft is wonderful and it's clever and their two actors are just delicious and their comic timing is impeccable and all of, you know, everything but after an hour, I was like, okay. But after 2 hours of that, I was like, I just felt like it would be bludgeoned by capitalism, by we're selling you our show. You know, and so it felt like it was all wrapped up in, we're selling you the gay taste, gay pop comedy taste, you know, and so I was like, I wanted to rebel against it because it felt like an attack almost.
Yeah. So I've never been to New York. I've never seen a Broadway show on Broadway. So this was my first.
That was your first Broadway musical?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there and I was like, suddenly it all makes sense.
What?
Like this whole genre. To the way they act, the way it looks, the way the people react to it. Because when they bring those things over to Germany, or even London, it's like, you don't get the vibe of that Broadway thing.
Because the Germans are amazing, but they will, it's hard to get a German to laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And they will, there's a weird etiquette that you have when you come to see theater where you basically sit on your hands and at the end you explode in appreciation for the work, right? There's this, like, everyone's cheers and claps louder than anybody, you know, at the end of the show, but you don't show your emotion throughout the entire show. And that's just not the American way. We're like, we gave you a joke and we want, if you didn't laugh, it meant that something was wrong, you know, like in our craft and our, you know, and this, the cultures are very different. And you really understand that when you, as a performer, you know.
In Germany, we have this, I think it's Brecht who said, like, oh, I want the audience to lay back and like this, smoke a pipe and look, like analyzing the thing that's happening there.
Right.
And I think it's still somehow in the German audience, who like, convince me. Yeah.
Oh,
and here I have I had the feeling it's like, curtain opens, Michelle Williams, and people are like,
are convinced,
going crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that's a beautiful aspect of American culture is, if you, I mean, the ugly side of that is you have to do the right thing for that. She came out in a dress that wasn't glittery and glamorous and perfectly fit her and da 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 da. The audience wouldn't necessarily do that. Because they hit all the marks, the audience is like, yes, we're here. We're here for the show.
Yes.
It's so clearly, this is either your taste or it isn't. There's no confusion. in the marketing.
No.
Right?
Not at all.
So the people that are there have bought in before they bought the tickets, and they're ready, you know, and they just want to enjoy themselves, and they want to be satisfied with their purchase, and they come with the expectation that they've asked for a burger their way and they're going to get it their way. And so that's that audience. That is that audience. And then what becomes very challenging is to make the kind of art that doesn't do that, but work with that audience and try to figure out how to convince them that your art, your craft and your art isn't bad and something to be dismissed or ignored simply because it doesn't give them what they were expecting. A director friend of mine, Dan Fisk, who did this Oklahoma that was kind of a new imagination. Mm-hmm.
The stripped down thing.
He said this really interesting thing to me. He said he thought that people came to the theater so that when the curtain goes up, they wouldn't know, they would be surprised and they wouldn't know what they were about to see. And in that experience, he learned a lot of people go to the theater, but when the curtain goes up, it's exactly what they thought they were going to see. And that is the great challenge of being an artist as opposed to a capitalist.
It's also a Brecht quote, I think, where it says, like, the audience likes to be surprised, but only by things they already know. Well, I was thinking, oh, Brecht is funny.
Is funny. And also, they were clowns. That whole ensemble was, they were all clowns. A lot of Lenya is the clowniest clown of clowns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how do you work? If you write for Broadway or work on Broadway, and because you also do like different stuff and produce differently than the Broadway style.
I don't really work on Broadway. I have worked on Broadway. It's a slight difference. You know, I wrote a play, Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus, that I wanted to do off Broadway, and I approached Scott Rudin, the producer at the time, who was, you know, like known to do things that were a little like, you know, a little off, a little different. He had just done an off-Broadway run of an Annie Baker play. And so I thought, oh, maybe Scott would be interested in producing off-Broadway this play. And I sent it to him, and the next day he called and said, I'm going to do it on Broadway. And I was flabbergasted. I thought, yeah, I want to do it on Broadway too, but I just didn't think anyone would. And to answer your other question about what I, you know, how do you make a Broadway show when that's not what you make? Or that, you know, and my answer is like, just because somebody said Broadway's about commerce doesn't mean that it has to be that way. And Broadway is essentially our national theater. And so we have a right to put art, we have a right and a calling and, to put art there, and the real estate moguls don't get to just decide what is art for the nation, because, you know, what's on Broadway trickles up to the larger culture often, if it's always just from perspective of commerce, then there's no dreaming the culture forward. There's just staying in the same place or devolving into MAGA land. You know, they don't have the right to own our culture. So I push back on it and push back on Broadway being a place of commerce. I think we need to take over.
But it doesn't seem to be easy.
No, it's impossible. And so, I mean, it's not impossible, but it's incredibly hard. And Scott Rudin said to me, you know, I wrote the part of Gary for myself, and he said, I can't do this play on Broadway without two stars in the two lead roles. And I wrote it for myself and for Christine Nielsen, who's a well-respected actor and had already been Tony nominated, but she wasn't a star. And I had to, and he gave me three options. He said, Al Pacino, Jeffrey Rush, or Nathan Lane. And I was like, well, I mean, they're all incredible actors. And I didn't know he'd actually just already offered the part to Al Pacino before he even sent it to me. So Al Pacino said yes, I guess. And he never returned Al Pacino's call because Because, and I would have preferred Jeffrey Rush myself, but he was going through a sex scandal thing at the time. I was like, I'm not going there. So then I was like, well, Nathan seems to be, you know, I just said yes. I shouldn't have said yes. I really shouldn't have. It wasn't Nathan or Jeffrey or Al Pacino or anything. It was, I just shouldn't have said yes to somebody saying that my art can't be my art and I'm my art. Right. So I should have just been, no, if you don't want to do it with me, then let's not do it.
Yeah.
No. But I wanted to have that Broadway experience. And so I have, you know, whatever. It was horrible and traumatizing experience to work on that play. Because it was like, I wasn't present. Not because I wasn't the lead, but because that wasn't, it was like that they took it over. They didn't invite me to my own process. You know, I wasn't allowed to come to rehearsal. I wasn't, you know, it was very strange. And
could you feel like that? I always imagine like this whole amount of money that's like in the background. Can you feel it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like they overspend on everything. You're like, why are you spending so much money? Like find a creative solution. It's more fun. You know, the money they spent, it was oppressive, the money they spent. But then it turns out, I don't think it was just about trying to give the best production of the play. It was also about investors. It was like purposely meant to lose money, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and so I thought that was from a nonprofit place of like, yeah, we're doing this thing that will lose money, but it was more from a like a write-off place.
So straight from the heart.
Straight from the heart. So, I mean, that's my impression. I don't know if you'd have to talk to the powers of find out if that was the truth, but they wouldn't tell you the truth, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's no point.
But if you're working on your own productions, like say the 24 American Music thing or something, how do you deal with the money side of it? So it's produced completely different.
That was Broadway produced show. Completely different, yeah. Well, I produced the first kind of few years of workshops and things on my own. And then this company called Pomegranate Arts came, we found each other. And they, when they got on board, you know, Linda Brombach, who's one of the co-founders, the leaders of Pomegranate Arts, along with Elisa Regas. I mean, I think both of them have a vision of being creative producers. You know, they're not just like, we're the money people. We're here to, you know, raise the money for you. Or, you know, they really want to find the creative solution. So they really worked with me and over a number of years. And we toured it as we were making it all over. We figured out that would be the best process for that piece. And we got everywhere we toured, we got them to give us a little commissioning money to help make it. So, you know, one theater, on top of the fee that we would get, we'd get an extra $5,000 commissioning thing that would help us make the big, larger piece. And we toured every, you know, there was a lot.
So you collected the money like by touring?
By touring, essentially. And by inviting many, many, many theaters to be part of the creation of the piece. So then it was became a giant group. Basic, you know, it's like in, it was theater of the people for the people by the people. Everybody was involved. And so that was a great model. But then when the pandemic hit, that model has gone away because all of the theaters, panicked and they don't want to work that way. You know, they don't want to give,
take a risk
$5,000 on something that they can't claim is theirs.
When you said like the art is you or something, or you are the piece of work, the work of art. Like, how did your art develop or something? Like, with what kind of culture, music did you grow up?
I mean, I grew up with musical theater, with Broadway musical theater. In America, if you're not from a major city, then you don't tend to get, I mean, at the time that I was growing up, now there's the internet, so you have access to many different cultures around the world, if you know what to Google, right?
Yeah.
You know what link to follow. But at the time, we had a couple movie theaters in the small city that I grew up in, and they all only showed Hollywood films. There were no art films. But I knew people who were curious about art films and stuff. So ever so often we'd go take drive to San Francisco and see an art film, or to Sacramento and see an art film, or to, you know, some nearby city where they had galleries and museums. And so I was exposed to culture a little bit at a time, just not in a relaxed way. It was like a special event to go to culture. And so when I finally moved to New York in 94, I didn't know that there were alternatives. I mean, I discovered Mabu Minds, and I discovered the Wooster Group, and I discovered La Mama and everything that was going on there. And it was flabbergasting. It was like this weight had been lifted from my chest. I suddenly thought, oh, this is what you can do, you know, because I was trying to squish my queer body and sensibility into something that wouldn't fit. You know, the commerce of theater is asking you to be one thing, reduce you down to one thing. And I felt like I was many things, and I didn't know how to reduce myself to something I could sell in a significant amount of time, you know.
Yeah.
Not a significant, but like in a very, you know, edited, clear, short, get it done, have one intermission so you can sell things, and then get it done quick after. You know, like, I didn't know how to do that. And also it didn't seem like my acting teachers were always like, you need to butch yourself up if you're going to get work. You know, like that, it was very much like, don't be gay, don't be yourself. But yet all the straight boys got to be themselves, you know? So,
yeah.
So it was an oppressive culture to kind of grow up in. Try to enter the industry with. It's very different now in a lot of ways, and the same in a lot of ways.
What did your parents listen to?
Oh, I mean, my parents weren't, I wouldn't call them sophisticated at all, but I think they wanted to be. So that is useful, I think, for a kid. But it was like James Taylor and, you know, like the Beatles were like the most sophisticated thing they listened to.
Yeah. Know? If you look at your own work, like, what kind of influences do you still think are in there?
You know, all of the Broadway musicals are still in me. You know, I'm a humorist and I'm an entertainer, and I like people to laugh. I like the laughter to take them to the consideration. And that's slightly different from someone who's just in it for the laugh. You know, both are valid and wonderful ways of working. And I just think there's a little bit more. It's just, there's maybe too much of the we're just in it for the laugh kind of material in America. On the flip side, in Germany, there might be not enough of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I like to entertain people. I just like want the entertainment to not be the point necessarily. I want it to be like just part of the process of getting to the point.
Yeah.
Getting to the content.
Yeah.
I believe in surprise, and I believe that when you surprise people, and by surprise I mean many things, but one of the things I mean is delight. You know, when you delight people, their hearts open, and then they're ready for to live. Right? But oftentimes people come to culture or experience or just engagement on the street with closed hearts. Mm-hmm. So it's like the theater is this place where we can all practice together how to open up our hearts.
Yeah, that's not very German.
No, no. But by hearts, I also mean minds, thoughts, the things that we wonder about, the debates we have. But how do we open up our hearts so that we can have real debates as opposed to just my opinion, your opinion? And that's not a debate. It's not Socratic. It's not a question, you know?
Yeah.
So the goal is like, how can entertainment be the thing that brings us to a communal consideration?
At the moment, what do you think like theater can do political wise, the whole, or is there, should theater do?
I'm definitely not the first person to say this because, you know, it's an obvious thing. I believe it feels pretty obvious that the issue is isolation. The MAGA people are isolated, so they're not, you know, people who aren't part of a resistance have isolated themselves. They're donating their dopamine to their phones. They don't want to hang out with people. They don't feel at ease with people. They don't want to practice being around people. Other people are the enemy. I've got to isolate myself to my tribe instead of see, you know, the great American experiment as a communal consideration, instead of see a multi-ethnic gathering as something that can help everybody, instead of seeing the world as something that we're all living in, and so we all must take responsibility for and care for, you know, instead it's become mine, gotta get mine, gotta get mine, gotta protect mine. And
theater is like the opposite.
And maybe. Theater can be the opposite. Theater is a place where we gather people together. We can, you know, it doesn't always work that way. It can be isolating to go to the theater often, but I think what it can do is bring people together and give them the experience of having communal consideration. So yeah, more theater, more theater, more theater, not less. Theater that asks you to be sitting next to a stranger and for that stranger to have a different response from you, and for you to learn about the play because they laughed in a part that you didn't laugh at, and to learn about the play because you laughed and your neighbor didn't laugh, and you think, oh, maybe I didn't understand that was actually more serious than I thought it was. And for you to be sharing space together while ideas are being sung and spoken and danced in front of you.
Yeah.
Also das, was ich positiv mit so einem gewissen Größenwahn, performativen Größenwahn meine, egal ob die Projekte dann ganz klein oder ganz groß sind, haben dann natürlich auch diese Arbeiten von Taylor Mac, wer sich da alleine hinstellt und 24 Stunden die komplette amerikanische Musikgeschichte durchsingt. Das hat ja quasi so eine Art von, ich erklimme hier einen Berg und ich kann diesen Berg auch erklimmen. Dieses queere, ich kämpfe mich durch, ich bin das Kunstwerk und mein Leben verwandle ich zu Kunst, und dafür suche ich mir hier in New York die kleinste Venue, und wenn ich Glück habe, steige ich bis zum Broadway auf, siehe Cole Escola, so hat das bei ihm ja funktioniert mit Oh Mary. Spricht ja eben auch aus den Arbeiten von Charles Bush, und von Charles Bush haben wir ja letzte Woche schon gehört. Da hat er ja darüber berichtet, wie sein Durchbruch passierte, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom. Und später hat er ja eben auch für den Broadway geschrieben. Und ich fand das eigentlich ganz interessant, so als Gegensatz zu seinen Arbeiten, die er dann in der Downtown quasi freien, experimentelleren Szene machen konnte. Weil dieses Broadway-Stück hieß The Tale of the Allergist's Wife, die Geschichte der Ehefrau des Allergologen. Quasi im Gegensatz zu Vampire Lesbians of Sodom, ja schon ein ziemlich straighter Titel. Also da deutet sich vielleicht auch schon so ein bisschen an, was dann passieren muss, auch für queere Autoren, wenn man dann am Broadway landet. Dann wird das ja alles so, was noch gay und queer ist, sublimiert in so seltsamen oder umgedeutet, muss umgeschrieben werden in so eine Art von heterosexuellen Geschichten.
By 1994, you know, we were so decimated by AIDS, you know, Bobby died, and an actress who worked with McGann Robinson, she died of AIDS, and our choreographer died. And, you know, it was just, I was ready to sort of also write plays for other people as well. And basically every play I've written that I've appeared in, it starts off with just, who would I like to be? You know, I'd love to be in a 1940s wartime melodrama where I liked playing people who start off with all wrong values. And just terribly selfish, and then through the course of the play, they learn and grow, and you know,
of course,
become a better person. So, like very typical, like the Lady in Question that we do with Theater in Limbo in 1989, and you know, because I love those movies with, you know, Norma Shearer or Joan Crawford, where, you know, and so I played. It was set in 1940, and I was this impossibly self-absorbed, very glamorous, successful concert pianist, Gertrude Garnet, and I'm on tour in Bavaria, 1940, and completely oblivious to anything that's going on in the world, you know, and Arnie played a young American professor who's in Germany because his mother, a famous German actress, she's imprisoned in a Nazi prison, and you know, and he enlists my aid in trying to help his mother escape. And I go, of course, I can't, I have my concert at the Festspielhaus. All this sort of thing. And then, you know, and Julie was my companion. She's the Countess de Borgia, you know, and she married well. So, you know, we're still kind of tough broads, and, She ends up helping, you know, the end of Act One was, you know, at the Baron's Schloss. And I happen to, you know, just open the door and out comes her swinging on the noose. And the curtain falls. You know. Anyway, so then I change. And you know, the last scene, of course, so we're escaping on skis. And I do this very big speech, you know, in lovely light, you know. And, but that was sort of typical kind of vehicle.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there really all the plays I've written for myself start with Allergist's Wife, my Broadway hit was, you know, years later. And I got involved in writing the book to the libretto to a musical called The Green Heart. And it was an adaptation of a movie called A New Leaf with Elaine May and Walter Matthau. And an actress friend of ours, Ken Mine, her husband was going to write the score. And so she kind of involved us. And she knew someone at Manhattan Theater Club, which is very one of the most prestigious nonprofit theaters in, well, the country, mm-hmm. certainly New York. So we did a workshop there. And Lynn Meadow is the artistic director for over 50 years. She's still there. And she's a very, very important lady and rather intimidating lady. You know, she's 6 feet tall, very important. Everybody was rather intimidated by her. And I didn't really care that much. You know, this is not my world. Because she really wanted to direct that show. But Ken was the director and he was a little bit, you know, feeling... He was used to being the boss, you know, because he had always produced our shows, but suddenly now it's a little different, and it's this big structure, and you know, she was being very dominating, and at one point she made some really stupid ideas, throwing it out, and I don't know, I felt very comfortable around her because I didn't really care. I can't believe I said that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, and everybody was like, and suddenly she's like. Nobody had spoken to her that way in 30 years. She started laughing. She said, I guess it really was a pretty stupid idea. And at that point, we were just bonded. And so then when the opening night came and the reviews were quite mixed, and she was just kind of crazy about me. And so anyway, she said that night, she said, I would like to produce your next play, whatever it is. She goes, I have to direct it. You know, I thought about it, and I thought, okay, I got to write her a play, and you know, it's very conservative. You know, not conservative politically, but you know,
it's a structure. It's like
the kind of plays they do, you know, and their subscriber audiences, you know, and I thought this is not the place to do Vampire Lesbians Part 2. I had a character that I had created from my act where I played this woman named Miriam Passman. Who was this cabaret performer and housewife, you know, wealthy housewife, but who does her act and she takes herself very seriously and she's not very good. And she's always playing like, you know, Sundays at 4:30, you know? And anyway, it was a funny character and I did it a lot at events and stuff. And I'd always thought it would be a good character to write a whole play about. And so this was this wonderful opportunity. I thought, oh, this is perfect for, you know, she would be a subscriber at Manhattan Theater Club, you know, the Miriam Passman. So I started writing that play, trying to come up with what would be the story to fit that lady. And I finished the play and I gave it to Lynn Meadow and she said, oh, let's do a reading of it right away. And who's, you know, they can get anybody. They're such a, you know, prestigious theater. Who's your fantasy casting for Marjorie? Yes, Linda Lavin. And so it got the play to her and we did this reading and she was extraordinary. It was just perfect. And so then, you know, she agreed to do the play and we, you know, they have the best, greatest resources. And, you know, we got Michelle Lee and Tony Roberts and, you know, Lynn directed it and, you know, and it was all very smooth. And so, you know, we opened and just, you know, got great reviews at their small, you know, I'm always in the second stage, you know, mm-hmm. I was in their small theater, but it went very well. And immediately there were plans to move to Broadway. I never thought that I could come up with something that 1,200 people would all find funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I always thought it was this rarefied gay subculture thing. And
yeah.
I felt so vulnerable. I was just watching all this and yeah. And then, on opening night, I got a telegram arrived. I thought, who do I know? Sounds like a telegram. And I opened it up. It says, welcome to the big time, Steve Sondheim.
Oh.
Yeah. I must say I was very protected, mm-hmm. you know, for one thing, it wasn't like I had submitted the allergist's wife to, you know, a process. You know, Lynn, I've written the book to that flop musical, Green Heart, and Lynn, you know, the colossal thing, sends me, write me a play, and I'll do it, you know. So, you know, I skipped the process.
Yeah.
Two things going on.
Yeah.
For one thing, I always wrote in commercial comedy rhythms.
Yeah.
It's part of who I am. I was never really an avant-garde artist, you know. It's just not in me, you know.
Where does this comedy rhythm come from? Another question. Sorry.
I think you're born with it, honey. Yeah. Plus I'd grown up watching old movies, you know. I'd just grown up with it. I didn't come from like this very conceptual place. I didn't come from like an art background, like some mm-hmm. performance artist or dance,
yeah.
you know, which would lead you into a more conceptual way of thinking. I think I would have been like that in a way. Do you know who Lindsay Kemp is?
Yes.
I remember seeing in After Dark magazine when I was very, very young, these pictures of Lindsay Kemp, these just wild costumes and blood coming down their faces and, you know, and think, oh, I wish, oh, I'd like to be, perform, I'd like to be that kind of person, but it's not in me. I write in a kind of a vaudeville style of set up punchline. It's just who I am.
So that's why it's not hard for you to write like a successful
because all of my show. But the gigs, the plays we did, you know, they may have been sort of outrageous in that, you know, Bobby's ass was showing and, you know, and I was female character and we got real bawdy. But I think one of the reasons we were a success, to be honest with you, one of the reasons Vampire Lesbians was a success and ran 5 years was that it seemed like it was going to be something so decadent. And then you get with as hard, it's a bit sentimental and written in very obvious comedy rhythms that you've seen on television. The straight audience going in to see Vampire Lesbians, they thought they were being rather adventurous going to see this play with that title, you know, but it's kind of old-fashioned. The two rival ladies, after 2,000 years of trying to destroy each other, at the end they realize that the only people they have to identify with are each other, the survivors.
Yeah.
And then they sort of patch it up at the end and they're going to do an act together.
Yeah.
So it's not a radical thought, you know.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. All the plays that we, early plays we did, you know, were kind of moral tales because I always, it's going from self-absorption to generosity of spirit.
Yeah. Was there the same development of characters in The Allergist's Wife?
No. Well, yes, in a way, I guess it's such a different story. Marjorie Taub, she's this wealthy wife of the allergist and beautiful at home, but she's feels so frustrated. You know, she wants to be an artist. Oh, you know, she has dreams of, you know, and she's reading Kierkegaard and she's reading all these things, but she's frustrated by her own limitations. You know, and and she's got this old elderly mother who's never been encouraging to her. Margie, write about what you know. You know, just and the husband is a good husband, but the main thing is she wants to be a writer, and you know, and she worked on a novel for, you know, 18 years, and it was turned down by every publisher, and she realized it was terrible, you know, and it was just this very pretentious thing. And so she's, when the play starts, she hasn't gotten dressed in days, you know, she's just in her robe and just, you know, and she had an incident at the Disney store on Fifth Avenue where she was like in a sort of strange state. She walked in and she started smashing figurines, patriarchal figurines, you know, the Little Mermaid's father. No, they, you know, so she's got a bandage on her arm, you know, and they're all very concerned. And yeah. So anyway, so that's where she starts. So then the doorbell rings, and it's this woman, Lee Green, who accidentally hit the wrong doorbell, is looking for another doorbell. And they realize that they knew each other as children. This strange thing. And Lee Green is this fabulous, you know, has this life. She's lived in Hong Kong and she's lived in Berlin. She's, you know, ran an art gallery and, you know, in Indonesia. She's been every, you know, she's known everyone. She was at the recording of We Are the World, you know. She's friends with Quincy Jones. She, you know, she's known everyone. And Marjorie's just, oh my God, just like in love. Suddenly Marjorie's reborn and everything. And but they begin to think, her husband and her mother, it's perplexed. You know, they've never met this woman. And they begin to think that maybe she's a figment of Marjorie's imagination. And in a certain sense, Marjorie, by the end of the play, through all this thing, has kind of emerged with a greater sense of who she is, yes, and kind of embracing the world.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess there is kind of a theme to everything,
yeah,
everything I do. But I find my life, you know, as when I, you know, is trying to the battle between self-absorption and just, you know, the world. And I think my aunt was always harping on that. She was so concerned that as this rather ethereal, dreamy child who is lost in his own world, to try to, you know, make me have a sense of the greater world around me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you make of the world at the moment? Like,
I'm so terrified. I take it all too so personally. I would not be surprised if I did not write any more plays.
Okay.
I just turned 70 and you know, I don't know. I mean, it's like, I'm not sure I really, as an actor, really want to do 8 shows a week anymore. It's really exhausting. And
that feeling before that you were so influential on also what happens now on Broadway with this O'Malley thing.
Well, I'm definitely a big influence on that.
Yes.
Cole's been really great. I mean, he's a lovely person. He's been, I tell you, he's been far more generous and thoughtful to me than I was to Charles Ludlum. I was too busy in my own fabulousness.
I mean, Cola's Cola, somehow like your daughter, son, whatever.
Yes, and he's really been, you know, I've said really thoughtful. I really like him a lot.
Also, his appreciation of the divas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're very similar.
Yeah,
very, very similar.
So yeah. No O'Malley without the lesbians. The lesbian nuns know the lesbian
and he'd be the first one to say so.
Yeah.